Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 16th, 2025, and our friends John Helmer and Ray McGoran are back with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about the two meetings that Steve Witkoff had with Vladimir Putin and with Iranians. And let's start with the first meeting that he had the day before Saturday and on Friday with Vladimir Putin. And here is what Witkoff said about that meeting on Fox News.
Used the very good word there, Sean, emerging. I do. This is the third meeting I've had with him. This last meeting lasted close to 5 hours. We had two of his key advisors in the room at the time, Ushakov and Kirill Dmitriev. And it was a compelling meeting. This peace deal is about these so-called five territories, but there's so much more to it. There's security protocols. There's no NATO, NATO, Article 5. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of detail attached to it. It's a complicated situation rooted in some real problematic things happening between the two countries. And I think we might be on the verge of something that would be very, very important for the world at large.
Ray, go ahead. What's your take on what Witkoff has explained for us about the meeting?
Well, in my view, this is the main show, Nima. Iran is a sideshow. Iran is, in circus terms, a freak show. When Witkoff says he spent 5 hours with Putin, that has to mean something. When the president 2 months ago said, you know, I can understand why the Russians really wouldn't want a heavily armed NATO member right on their border there in Ukraine. I can understand why they will. Well, that speaks volumes. So what we have here is a situation where Witkoff is expressly saying, look, it's not only about those five provinces or Crimea and the four provinces. It's about what the Russians have always insisted on, respecting their core interests. And if we're close to a big deal on that, well, that's a big deal. Now, the proof is in the pudding, and the devil is in the details. There's many for another. There's a slip between cup and lip. But Trump and Witkoff, his agent, are trying their damnedest to create a good situation between Russia and the U.S. And they are fighting not only hardliners in Russia, but hardliners here at home. The administration is hopelessly divided between the people that Trump was forced to pick when he picked the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. And so it's a battle royale, and it's not clear how it's going to come out. But I think its relationship to Iran speaks for itself. The Iranians and the U.S. are talking to each other now. And if further proof were needed, of course, we know that Witkoff is meeting again this Saturday on the 19th. So things are, I think we can breathe easier on Iran. And actually, we can proceed with some hope that Trump, through Witkoff, his agent, will be able to face down not only hardliners in Russia, but hardliners right here in the United States. That's my take.
John, go ahead.
I'm very glad Ray talked about breathing easier, because we can all breathe a little easier on the threat to go to war against Iran. But we also have to notice that when President Trump issued his medical report the other day, he said, and his naval doctor said, he's got a 99% oxygen level. Now, I've had geriatricians and medical experts look at that medical report, and it's fake. Nobody, unless they've just jumped out of a hyperbaric chamber, has a 99% oxygen level. On the other hand, to look at how much oxygen is bubbling through people's heads, let's just go back to Mr. Witkoff. Mr. Witkoff's job is to represent the political fortunes and the ambitions of the President of the United States. To that extent, and to the extent the Russian side wants a better relationship with the United States and wants to end the war the United States has been waging against Russia, President Putin is ready to have, at very short notice, on Witkoff's request, meetings for as long as Witkoff wants to sit there. On the other hand, what Witkoff then says is a hustle. It's a hustle for the benefit of President Trump. If one listens to what Foreign Minister Lavrov had to say a few hours ago, it's in Kommersant newspaper, the Moscow business newspaper, the serious Moscow newspaper today. Lavrov was asked what agreements have been reached with the United States. And he said, and I'm looking at the page to read it exactly to you. He said it twice. Let me answer your last question right away. The answer is no. Agreeing on the key aspects of the settlement is easy. We are discussing them, meaning it's continuing. And then he was asked later and said the same thing. From what you have said, it sounds like Moscow, this is the question, Moscow still believes the US can be a negotiator in the Ukraine conflict. There have already been two US mediated agreements, one on safe navigation of the Black Sea, and another on the moratorium on strikes against energy infrastructure, but neither seems to be fully functioning. What's your take on that? Lavrov, there are no such agreements, okay? So what we have, and the difference between what we wish, what is real and in a war, and what Witkoff is saying, is that on the one hand, there have been negotiations. There were negotiations in Riyadh between Rubio and Waltz on the one hand and Lavrov and Ushakov on the other hand, which then in turn led to two separate tracks. First track, Black Sea Initiative, ceasefire in the Black Sea. Nothing has been achieved on that issue. Nothing at all. Why? Because Trump and Witkoff and Lutnik, the commerce secretary, and their business allies are a very large way away from agreeing to reduce sanctions on Russia. They're unwilling to discuss real reduction of financial and other forms of sanctions on Russia. In today's piece, I indicate. On Dances with Bears, that there is one tiny sop that's being paid by Witkoff to the Russian oligarchs whom Kirill Dmitriev represents, and that is that Trump has disassembled a task force in the Department of Justice called Klepto Capture, whose objective was to pursue oligarch violations of the sanctions on them. That's really an allowance for the oligarchs to pay the bills on their mansions abroad in Washington, New York, Colorado, and their toy boats, which are parked all over the world. It's not a serious reduction in the economic war. That's one point. Second, yes, there is improvement on the track, and Lavrov confirms what has happened. On the track of normalizing between the State Department and the Russian Foreign Ministry and the embassies on both sides. So visas can begin to be issued, the toilets can be unblocked in each place because the local plumbers can't be hired and that sort of stuff. And it's even possible that Aeroflot can begin to fly normally between Moscow, Washington and New York. There is improvement on that track, which was negotiated and is being negotiated by Ms. Coulter at the State Department, a Deputy Assistant Secretary for Europe, and Alexander Dachev, the new Russian ambassador to the United States. But that too isn't finalized in a piece of in the required papers to even get the two sides' banking arrangements, their local bank accounts working. So what's going is slow. Is it because there's an underlying resistance to Trump Witkoff and Lutnick, the three friends, the Troika at the top, is there a deep state resistance which they can't control, not even when the Secretary of Defense starts purging his own personal staff? I'm not sure, because I'm not here to discuss what goes on inside Washington. But there is, I'd have to say, and Mr. Witkoff's statements don't convince me or Mr. Lavrov, there is a genuine, comprehensive readiness to meet the Russian side, not only on the on battlefield ceasefire, not only on making political settlement with the five regions, and then the required security guarantees for the eight regions, led by Sumy region, which is the takeoff place for attacks on Kursk and Belgorod region. We can see efforts in those directions, but every time Trump makes an effort, by effort means he gets up in the morning, he has his hyperbaric chamber oxygenation level raised, he puts on his makeup to cover the rosacea on his face, which we've learned about in his medical report, and then finally gets around to writing a tweet. And some of these tweets indicate hopefulness, which we all share, against war, which we don't want to see escalate. On the other hand, Trump himself and his business allies aren't ready to reduce the major economic sanctions against Russia. When we can see that happening, then I could raise hopefulness.
Ray, the case of sanctions that John mentioned is so important, so serious in the mind of Russians. What's your take on that?
Well, actually, the Black Sea deal really involved lifting some of the sanctions. So John is quite right in emphasizing this aspect of it. What is also necessary to mention is that it was the Europeans that put the kibosh on this. Access to SWIFT, access to the financial agreements that had already been made 2 years ago and then renewed once, and finally the Russians said, okay, you're not going to live up to the terms, forget about it. The Black Sea Initiative is not important. Commerce continues. Ukrainian as well as Russian ships can get out and deliver food. So this was sort of a sop by Trump to say, okay, hey, let's do a deal here. It sort of worked, and then the culprits are proven to have been the Europeans. Now, with respect to commercial relations, Dmitriev, well, John and I disagree on his significance. I think when he came as the first Russian representative to Washington since the beginning of the war back in February 2022, that was really significant. He talked with all the big boys, this kind of big boy, okay? And actually, if I'm not mistaken, let me review what Witkoff told Fox News yesterday. Oh, yeah, he says there is a possibility to, quote, reshape Russia United States relationship through very compelling commercial opportunities. Oh, wow. He said that these would provide a basis for real stability in the region. Quote, partnerships create stability. So I think that the way Trump and Witkoff come at this, and the way Dmitriev was happy to come to Washington, after all, he had been in Saudi Arabia as well and sort of was allowed to come in at the end of those first negotiations. I think that's a big part of this. And what I hear Witkoff saying here is, look, this may be a really big deal, bigger than you ever thought, because there are economic opportunities, there are financial opportunities, which we discussed in detail with Dmitriev. And as you'll recall, Dmitriev said on his way back to Moscow, we made three steps forward. So it's always a case of whether you consider the glass of water full or empty, or maybe half full. I see it three quarters full. I see that Trump and Witkoff will be able to prevail against these non-entities like Rubio and Walz, whom he was compelled to to nominate in the beginning. I see them not long for this world. I think Kellogg will probably be dismissed within the next 10 days, mark my words. And so I think there's ample room for hope. Now, of course, you have naysayers in Russia. You're going to do another agreement. They're going to welch again. They betray everything they promise. How do you know this is going to work? That's in Moscow. The generals, how do you know it's going to work? The U.S. is still brandishing the sword. And of course, the neocons that persist and have considerable influence in Washington. Will Trump prevail? Who knows? But my guess is it's that glass is three quarters full at this point.
John, from what I understand, what Witkoff said is that they're talking not only on the issue of Ukraine, but they're talking about NATO. I don't know if he has mentioned the security architecture of Europe. How do you see those important issues, not only Ukraine, but also the situation with NATO and security architecture? Do you think that they have already started talking about them, or they're just focusing on the case of Ukraine, then talk about NATO and other things?
Let me try and answer this way, Nima. Don't let me go off track, okay? Let me make sure I come back to your point. Let me address where Ray and I agree underneath the apparent disagreement. Both sides currently have the same political theory of how lobbying at the top works. Mr. Witkoff's job is to raise the business lobby support for a Trump settlement of war and a restoration of relations with the United States. He's to raise a business lobby that can prevail and generate the waves of media propaganda that would accord with that. The same on the Russian side. Kirill Dmitriev's job is to raise a business lobby support for whatever terms the two presidents can come to and make a peace, even if it's a temporary peace over the next 4, 5, or 10 years, acceptable to the business interests of Russia. Now, with that theory of lobbying makes a president decide, which I believe to be primitive in the United States and primitive in Russia, Trump has a serious disadvantage. He doesn't have much time. The midterm elections come on within 18 months. And everybody in presidential politics knows that an incoming president really only has about 12 months to show his electability and to hold his party support in Congress, and in Trump's case, hold the support of Congress in the midterms. If Trump is facing a combination of high inflation, continuing war, potential casualties, and no dramatic returns to his business contributors to his campaign, he's going to face a wipeout in the midterms. But Russia understands that if Trump is wiped out in the midterms in 18 months, not a very short time away, then his capacity to make any significant agreement with Russia would be severely diminished. So Trump is in a hurry. And you can see that in the generation of tweets that follow every day. And I urge our audience to look at the rollcall.com, which carries every day a compilation of every tweet Trump issues, plus every minute of the day, according to the official White House log, which does show. That the principal activity in a Trump week is playing golf, not listening to intelligence reports, and not conducting what would be normally considered presidential business. Still, Trump's in a hurry. Putin is not in a hurry. Re-election, not until 2030, although the presidential succession campaign is always underway. And Dmitriev's one of the potential candidates. So proving peace now is a tweet theme. It's also a political necessity on both sides. Now, that's let me come. So that's the background driving politicians as politicians. That's what we've got. Now, to come back to your question about NATO and about the security architecture of Europe. Yes, Russia understands. Putin understands very well. The Security Council understands. The General Staff, the Foreign Ministry understand that the long-term peace between the United States, Russia, and Europe depends on a mutual security arrangement that's reciprocal. Our security and your security are indivisible, the Russians have kept saying. Now, again, let me refer back to Foreign Minister Lavrov's interview with Kommersant that was published today in Moscow. He repeats, go back to the December 2021 treaty draft that we present the United States, that we presented to NATO allies, in which we are offering mutual and indivisible reciprocal security guarantees between us, stable borders, and non-threatening military movement, especially in the nuclear armament sphere. He's reminding everybody that Russia has a security framework, and we'll come to it later, also a security framework for the Persian Gulf. But that's the context in which the foreign minister keeps saying, and he said it today in Moscow this morning, look at the ways in which we can bring Europe, in particular the Eastern European countries that became NATO members since 1997, into a stable form of non-threatening relationship, bolstered by commercial advantage on all sides, and improving prosperity, lower prices for gas, and so on. So yes, the Russian side keeps saying it. Now, Witkoff, on the other hand, isn't spending 4.5 hours listening to President Putin, Kirill Dmitriev, and Yuri Ushakov explain that. He's in a hurry for his boss. And that's why he says what he says, sometimes contradicting himself. That's why his boss is in a hurry. So between those with time politically, those who have less time politically, you've got a tension. And that's not easy to solve at the moment when, as Ray said, the devil's in the details. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. The proof of the war is when the fighting stops at lines that are stable and secure for the Russian side and secure for the US, European, and Ukrainian side. And those lines aren't things that Witkoff can address. He's addressed them, let's say, ambiguously and in a contradictory way. He says one thing one day, one thing another way. I wonder whether he understands the difference, but I think he understands the difference between 5 and 8. That's arithmetic. There are 5 regions. Witkoff is now saying he and his boss are prepared to concede to Russian sovereignty forever. Crimea, Kherson, Zaporozhye, Lugansk, and Donetsk, the 5 regions. But he's talked around the more, the 8. That's the buffer zone regions, Dnipropetrovsk, Sumy region, and Kharkov region possibly. This is the zone of the so-called demilitarized, the DMZ. Now, the DMZ is a concept we've been reporting for more than a year now, but General Kellogg came out with his DMZ version the other day, indicating that there would be a DMZ, exactly how he only had it a few miles wide, add a few hundred kilometers to that. And you've got a notion on all sides in Washington that a DMZ, meaning a security zone lying between the westernmost Russian border of the 5 extending to Kiev and possibly beyond Kiev, a security zone would have to be established to prevent, as the Russians have often said, no drone attacks, no long-range missile attacks and so forth on Russian territory. And that in turn would have to be policed. Now, Kellogg is saying that he'll have a Starmer Macron force in the far west. Okay, that's unacceptable to the Russian side. That's sort of boots on the ground. And all of that's unclear. And as Ray said, Kellogg may be gone in a few days. Some of the things he says tells you that he already knows he's already gone, that he's talking to someone else, not to the President of the United States. But what we have then are a combination of factors that those who are in a hurry need to get out quickly to keep their jobs, to preserve their power, to make sure the voters think they're doing the right thing. And those who are not in a hurry, but in a militarily advantageous position to assure that for the long term, there won't be war for a long term.
Ray, go ahead.
Sure. Oh, thanks, John. Yeah, let me broaden it out a little bit as to who's in a hurry. Clearly, Trump is in a hurry. He wants to get this thing done. But so is Putin. Putin has put himself way out on a limb. After all these betrayals by the U.S., and I don't really need to put the quotation marks around those because the main players have admitted now that they were betrayed, the Russians were betrayed. With all of those betrayals, Putin is saying, look, I think the President of the United States is sincere. In my opinion, he says that twice in this major speech up there in Murmansk, okay? So in my opinion, the President of the United States is sincere. We're going to be able to deal with him, okay? Now, that's big because Putin has his own generals and his own hardliners looking over his shoulder. And he's saying very confidently, we can deal because I think there's a measure of trust now. There has been no trust since 2013, when in December and the following February, Nuland did that little coup in Kiev. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that Putin would like to get this thing done. He's deliberately attriting, and showing the world that he can attrit much faster if need be, okay? So he's ready to cut a deal. Does he want to take all of Ukraine? On no circumstances. He knows what Vietnam was like, right? He knows what Afghanistan was like, okay? He doesn't want to do that. Does he want to take over Poland and the Baltic? No, he doesn't want to do that either. So there are the makings of a deal there, okay? Now, what is his main concern? His main concern was reported in those draft treaties, December 2021, okay? They were given not only to NATO, but to the U.S., in mid-December. On 21 December 2021, Putin met with his supreme commanders, all the equivalent four-star generals and admirals, and said, and I quote, the U.S. doesn't have any hypersonic missiles now, but they're going to get them soon. And when they do, they're going to put them in Ukraine. And that will give us 4 to 5 minutes time to react. Now, I didn't see the faces of the generals and the admirals, but I think I know what happened. 9 days later, there was a very hurried call from the Kremlin to the White House. Mr. Putin would like to speak to Mr. Biden, like right away, please. Why? They just talked 2 weeks ago. We have negotiations starting in Geneva in just 10 days. Why now? Please, Mr. Putin would really like to speak to Mr. Biden now. The date was December 30th. Where was Biden? He was home alone. He didn't have Sullivan. He didn't have Blinken with him. And to his credit, he took the call. What was the readout? The readout was the President of the United States, Mr. Biden, agreed that he has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, period, end quote. Whoa, what did Ushakov say the next day? My God, this is terrific. They are fulfilling the majority of the provisions in the draft treaty that we just tabled. They're taking our concerns seriously for the first time in years, okay? Rejoicing. It was New Year's Eve, okay? What happened? Well, we know that when our negotiators, headed by Wendy Sherman, appeared in Geneva, and her opposite number, Ryabkov, said, okay, let's get down to brass tacks now. Let's make sure we fill out and make sure we conclude this agreement on no offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. Wendy Sherman said, huh? What? I don't know anything about that. What? Say that again. He said it again. I have no instructions on that. That was on the 12th of February 2021. On the 21st of February. I'm sorry. This is January now. We're still talking about January.
January 2021.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the 12th. Now on the 21st, Lavrov found out that Blinken was in town in Geneva, and they got together. And he said, now, Tony, what about this agreement that you know about what Biden promised or what he undertook not to do on the 30th of December? Surely he's told you. Well, your negotiators pretend not to know anything, but what's going on? And Blinken said, forget about it. He was home alone. We weren't with him. Forget about it. We're not going to agree to any promise not to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. My God. Well, you know, if the Ukrainians ask us, we'll do it. But, you know, we're willing to talk about limiting the number of those things. But so that's what Lavrov reported back to Moscow. That was the final betrayal, okay? That was president to president, for God's sake. And he's undermined by these people like Blinken. And that was one of the main things which sent Putin up there to Beijing to say, big brother, you're going to support me? And Xi Jinping says, yeah, as long as you don't start this thing until after the Winter Olympics in Beijing are finished. They finished on the 20th of February. On the 24th, we had the special military operation. So all I'm saying here is that this is the background that Putin is working against, and he's still saying that's a measure of trust, and I think Trump is honest. Now, what's the last thing here? Okay, another reason why Putin is in somewhat of a hurry. He doesn't know how long Trump is going to be around.
Exactly.
Now, you know, this sounds a little strange, but the last president under whom, the first president under whom I served, his name was John F. Kennedy. And he was the last president to reach out to the Soviet Union at the time to point out that we were allies during World War II, that never before have our two countries been in a major war once against the other, unique among major powers in the world. We can deal, our children are our, we want the same things for our children, let's deal, okay? You know what happened to John Kennedy, okay? Now, I do not exaggerate. There is strong resistance to any rapprochement, much less détente, with Russia now. And the people whom Trump has threatened to expose now, not with the, only with the JFK papers, but with the papers that will be released by the FBI under Kash Patel, who knows where everybody is buried with respect to Russiagate and how they lied and stole and perjured themselves. I'm talking about the head of the FBI, James Comey. I'm talking about the head of the CIA, John Brennan, and the rest of that crowd, okay? They have the goods on them. Now, they have a lot to lose. They could end up in jail. What are they going to do? Are they going to sit back and say, well, let's pray and hope that Trump is not so vindictive that he'll have to come up? I don't know. But all I'm saying is that if I were the president's daily brief advisor of Mr. Putin, I would be saying, these things to Vladimir Vladimirovich, I would say, look, there is incentive to, for you to move quickly. You have Trump and Witkoff. If they can prevail, you could cut a really good deal. You won't get everything you want on Ukraine, but you know what you want has been so exaggerated in the West that the deal will look good to everyone, and you can do it because this guy is somebody you could deal with. I hope that's the way it comes out. As I say, I'm about three quarters of a glass sure that it will. But you know, the other thing is there's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and there's the Middle East, and then there's all this tariff stuff. I mean, Trump, if he survives all this, you know, that's another reason I think Trump, that Putin would say, let's deal now. If we have to say that Odessa, for example, can be a internationally regulated port, we could do that. As long as the guarantees are straight, we can appear flexible. Let's do a deal. And I see Witkoff saying, well, we're very close. We may have a major announcement in the near future. Wouldn't it be nice if that came before the 80th anniversary celebrations of the end of the war in which we and the Russians were allies?
Yeah. John, do you want to add something?
I entirely agree with Ray. Yes, Mr. Putin has been told that better to do something to sustain Trump's survival in the next 12 to 18 months and see what that does to the survivability of security between the two states. So, I don't have any more to add to Ray's construction. I entirely agree. I think the evidence is President Putin is in almost as much of a hurry to support Trump to the extent possible as Trump is in a hurry to support himself.
We know that in that meeting on Friday, it probably they talk about the case of Iran, because on Saturday Witkoff wanted to talk with Iranians. And we had the meeting between Iran, the two parties, Iranians and the United States. They said the outcome was positive. And here comes it seems that the United States is changing its rhetoric toward these sort of negotiation talks with Iran. Here is what Witkoff said about the negotiation, the talks in Oman on Fox News.
Peace through strength, it resonates throughout the world. This is not a threat on my part now. It is just a simple fact. The president means what he says, which is they cannot have a bomb. The conversation with the Iranians will be much about two critical points. One, enrichment. As you mentioned, they do not need to enrich past 3.67%. In some circumstances, they're at 60%. In other circumstances, 20%. That cannot be. And you do not need to run, as they claim, a civil nuclear program where you're enriching past 3.67%. So this is going to be much about verification on the enrichment program, and then ultimately verification on weaponization. That includes missiles, the type of missiles that they have stockpiled there, and it includes the trigger for a bomb.
What's so amazing to me that it seems when you follow the Iranian media and the way that the foreign minister of Iran talked about the negotiation, he said they didn't talk about ballistic missiles, that it was only focused on nuclear program. And they didn't mention anything about the enrichment as Witkoff was mentioning. Here is what Witkoff posted yesterday. He said, Iran must stop and eliminate its nuclear enrichment and weaponization program. And he wants the Iran to stop enrichment. When you look at the Iranian media, the foreign minister of Iran today said that is not something to negotiate on the part of Iranians. And moments ago, we've learned that the Iranian foreign minister is going to Russia. He has a letter from the supreme leader of Iran to deliver it to the Vladimir Putin. And Ray, what's your take on what's going on between the United States and Iran and the way that the Trump administration is trying to, I don't know, somehow changing the rhetoric on their part?
Well, the Zionists that Trump has to contend with are much more avid with respect to destroying Iran than they care about Ukraine. That's a given, okay? Back under Bush, the Zionists, the neocons used to say, real men don't go to Baghdad. Real men go to Tehran, right? Okay. So that's the deal, that's the backdrop for how Trump has to look at all this. The big thing is, what did Witkoff do before he went to Oman? Okay. He went to Moscow. I mean, it was though he was receiving instructions. Go to Moscow first and hear out what Putin is willing to do under their comprehensive treaty with Iran, Moscow, Tehran. Okay. Hear what Putin wants to say about that. Okay. So it was not only about Ukraine, it was about what Witkoff was going to encounter with the Iranians and what he could say to them with some confidence, knowing how Moscow felt, okay? Now, this whole thing about enrichment, okay? This whole thing about 60% enrichment, you know, the Iranians don't need 60% enrichment, not even for their nuclear research stuff. All they need is 20%. So, you know, are they willing to climb down on that? I think they would. Okay. So it's sort of a canard. What I mean is that even before the JCPOA, the joint plan for what is it, the joint
comprehensive plan.
Yeah, comprehensive plan, right? Even before that, you had Brazil and Turkey, if memory serves, willing to moderate or to do a little deal between Iran and US and Israel, having to do with enrichment, having to do with all these things. And the JCPOA, of course, concretized and made it impossible for Iran to do the kinds of things that Israel most feared. So Trump got out of that thing. Would he be willing to climb down and get back in? Yeah, but he'd have to disguise it in some kind of way. And that's what you have Witkoff saying, no enrichment, right? Well, they're negotiating positions, for God's sake, okay? You don't need 60% enrichment. And the Iranians say, okay, we don't need, okay. You should go down to 3.67%. Well, we can't do that because we have a research reactor. We need 20%. Oh, okay, we got a deal. It's negotiable. And if worse comes to worst, there are provisions or there are suggestions from the Brazilians and from the Turks and from the Russians. You know, we could take this highly enriched stuff and keep it for you and get it out of Iran and make sure everybody's satisfied. Even that is possible. Iran doesn't want to have a war, okay? And the sounds coming out of Witkoff and out of the Iranians are really reassuring to me. The fact that Iran is sending a top official to Moscow now, that's also reassuring. I think everybody's kind of talking to one another for the first time since Biden left, for God's sake. And I'm more optimistic. I'm about five-eighths full when I talk about no war on Iran. My colleagues, I hasten to assure you, who look at it more in a military way and say how prepared we are with those stealth bombers and everything else in the area, they look at it very differently. I agree that the capability is there for a major strike on Iran. I don't think it's going to happen because I think Witkoff has his head screwed on, right? He knows the implications of this, and Trump must be getting the word, look, we can do a deal with Iran as well as do a deal with Russia if we do this triangulation thing where we get everybody in sync.
John?
Well, Ray and I agree underneath it all, but if I'm to buy a bottle of beer from Ray, I'm a bit unclear whether I'm going to get two-thirds full or a full bottle or a three-quarters bottle. And so this is a bit tricky here, because we're not buying bottles and we're not drinking them either. What happened in Oman was indirect. We know that Witkoff was in one room. We know that Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister of Iran, was in another room, and that that there was a shuttling to and fro by the Omani foreign minister. That the Iranians have confirmed that was the way the indirect talks worked, and there were probably no exchange of papers at that time. The two men, Witkoff and Araghchi, met on the way out and shook hands, although there's no photograph. What we now know is Mr. Araghchi will be in Moscow. We know that there was an Iranian, Chinese, Russian troika meeting on the nuclear issue a couple of days back. And we know that there is one part of what Witkoff has said in the clip you mentioned and in the tweet you mentioned. He said no weaponization. Now, that's a complete non-starter. That's the part that tells us two things. One, the Israelis want to dismantle the capability Iran has already demonstrated of breaking through Israel's so-called Iron Dome and other defenses and strike Israel to a degree Israel cannot accept or survive. So essentially what weaponization means when Witkoff says it is a demand for unilateral disarmament of Iran. And that's not going to happen. It's not negotiable. On the other hand, the Iranian terms are the reduction of sanctions. There's no mention in Witkoff's statements that the US side is willing to consider and implement a program of sanctions reduction. So I agree with Ray. On the one hand, we're at the point in which the Trump administration would agree to revive the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan terms, which it walked away from before. Second, the Iranian side and the Russian side will not agree to the weaponization, the unilateral disarmament. And there have been several reports I've seen over the last 24 hours of the so-called hardline US and Israeli conditions, all revolving around one, weaponization, two, installation of inspectors throughout Iran to not only inspect the reduction of nuclear capability, but to inspect the dismantlement of Iran's drone and missile capability. These levels of intrusive inspection, way beyond JCPOA, will not be acceptable. The more Witkoff and the Israelis push it, the more Iran and it's the constituencies behind Khamenei and Pezeshkian in Iran think that what the objective here is regime change. It's to force such a disagreement among the forces in Iran that the military would see a threat to themselves if the civilian side agree on the demilitarization, disarmament provisions, inspection provisions that Israel and the United States want to enforce. When I see Witkoff say weaponization, W and W, I understand this is the Israeli position, and this is, if this is the Trump position, we're not going to get to agreement soon.
Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, well, on this we fundamentally disagree, John. Weaponization to me means making a weapon that can be put on a missile or on a plane, and you put the highly enriched uranium in there, and then you have a nuclear weapon. Now, the US intelligence community for 22 years has said, and I quote the most recent threat assessment of 3 weeks ago, Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2023 and has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. We say that with high confidence. We say that unanimously. All 16 U.S. intelligence agencies said that in 2017, and it's been repeated every year since. So if we're talking about a weapon, then what Witkoff and everybody else is doing is they're pushing on an open door. You can't get a nuclear weapon. Well, the intelligence community says that they don't have one and they're not working on one. And they also say that there's a fatwa. In other words, there's a religious edict against this. And the person that put that fatwa in 2003 is Khamenei. He's still a supreme leader. And there is no evidence, to quote the threat assessment, there is no evidence that Khamenei has, quote, reauthorized, end quote, the nuclear weapons development program. Now, when that estimate came out in November of 2007, saying they had stopped in 2003, it was not only unanimous and high confidence, but Bush and Cheney said, we don't agree. Bush went to Tel Aviv and he said, I don't agree with that assessment, okay? Because they wanted to have, they wanted to start a war with Israel against Iran on their way out, right, in 2008. Bush, in his memoir, says, you know, that estimate, that deprived me of the military option for, and this is a quote, for how could I authorize a military strike on the nuclear facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active weapons, nuclear weapons program? Bummer, I can't do that. He wrote that. They must have written that themselves. So what I'm saying here is there's a parallel here. There's an open door, and every time Witkoff or anybody says, you must not work on a nuclear weapon, they know full well that they're not working on it. And the press, the media never puts the two together. In other words, they're like this. So what I'm saying here is that when weaponization is the coin of the realm, they're not doing it, okay? And they can't have a nuclear capability without doing a nuclear weapon. Now, the last thing here is verification. Wow. How soon would we, how would we know? How would we know if they're doing that? Well, there are cameras up the kazoo in all kinds of places in Iran. There are satellites that have not only photographic, but multispectral and radar thermal imagery. And to his credit, I guess Bill Burns, the outgoing CIA director, I guess he wanted to sort of do penance for all the lies that he told before about Iran and other things. He said, you know, they're not working on a nuclear weapon, those Iranians. And, you know, we would learn right quick. We would learn right quick if they were. So a lot of this is a red herring. A lot of this is a canard. And when Witkoff brags about, as he eventually will, we stopped them from making a nuclear weapon, they haven't been working on it since 2003. And that's what the intelligence community, to its credit, has continued to say.
Let's be clear. Ray and I basically agree. But the issue is, let's ask Mr. Witkoff, what does he mean by weaponization? Is he talking about warhead, the development of the capacity to have a nuclear warhead? Or is he talking about the delivery vehicle, the capacity to have conventional or nuclear warheads that Iran uses to defend itself and has used to attack Israel in retaliation for Israel's attacks? Let's ask Mr. Witkoff, what do you mean by weaponization, Mr. Witkoff? And let's notice that nobody else in the American press has asked him, what do you mean by weaponization, the warhead or the delivery system? Because there's a fundamental difference there, and one is not negotiable from the Iranian side, and one is, as Ray said, it's an open door.
Well, John, weaponization has always meant a nuclear warhead be put on these missiles. The missiles, I agree with you, that's a bone of contention too, but the missiles were deliberately kept out of the JCPOA. Yes. Now, it could be that the Iranians will be flexible enough to put some sort of limits on their missiles to make sure they're not attacked, But weaponization has always meant the nuclear warhead. And most people say it's months, maybe a year, before the Iranians could actually develop one and that we would detect it, as Bill Burns admitted, almost right away. So it's a canard. It's a useful one because our press never mentioned it. So, as I say, Trump and Witkoff can say we prevented them from creating a nuclear weapon. I think that's what's afoot here. And I think that it's a real shame that, as you suggest, John, nobody says to the White House or the State Department spokesperson, now, wait a second. Now, wait a second here. The intelligence community says and has said since 2007, there's no active nuclear weapons program. You're talking about not letting do a nuclear weapon. How do you reconcile that? Nobody says that. That's part of the bigger problem that we have with the media.
John, you've mentioned something important, that it is the regime change in Iran. And if we assume, in my opinion, is a total fantasy, by attacking Iran, you can change the regime in Iran. It's not even imaginable, in my opinion. But if we assume that they have it in their mind, and what does it mean for Russia, regime change in Iran? And how do they interpret that?
Pardon me. We've talked about this before, Nima. There's a very long 200-year history of Russia-Iranian relations in which the two sides have been in combat with one another and untrusting of one another and so forth. Russia's fundamental position is that Iran must not become a platform for threats to Russia's southern flank, in the same way that Russia's policy towards Turkey and the current disorder and civil strife in Turkey has the possibility of a regime change in Turkey, which would create a Turkish threat to Russia from the present situation. So regime change in Iran is regarded as a destabilizing threat to Russia's security. At the same time, Russia considers that nuclearization and nuclear weapons standoff between Israel, the United States, and Iran threatens nuclear war on Iran on Russia's southern border. That too is a fundamental security threat to Russia. So Russia's positions are very clear, and they've been clear for years. Russia has favored regime change under Stalin, for example, during World War II and after World War II, in the hope that Iran would not be the Anglo-American platform to attack the Soviet Union that it was believed to be then. And Stalin had troops in northern Iran for that purpose, and he supported the Tudeh Communist Party in Iran for that purpose. But ultimately, reluctantly, Russia, the Soviet Union, came to a modus vivendi with the Shah and wasn't at all upset when he fell. On the other hand, Russia and the Soviet Union took the position that Saddam Hussein should not have attacked Iran and produced that destructive war for both sides. That was Soviet and Russian policy at the time. So Russia's framework for Iran has been put again by the foreign ministry in a concept for Persian Gulf security. And we've talked about this in the program before. That has the same principle as in the treaty that Ray and I've been mentioning for NATO and the United States, indivisible reciprocal security. That means that Israel can't threaten Iran with nuclear attack and destruction. Iran will not develop weapons in a framework in which neither the Arabs nor Israel nor Iran will threaten each other. And the Russian concept is only a concept. It's a plan for working on all sides, involving Israel's concessions too. But Israel makes no concessions. Israel's in expansionist mode. Israel is committing genocide as it expands. And Israel has taken a big chunk of Syria right now. So the Russian security concern about Iran means practically at this moment, no resistance to any form of attack, economic or military or political, that means regime change.
Ray, go ahead.
Well, I agree with John's depiction of Russia's attitude toward Iran. I would just go back a little bit farther. I'm a child of World War II, which dates me, but that makes me older than John and others. During World War II, of course, Iran was the key point for the U.S. supplying all kinds of deuce and a half, with the 2.5-ton trucks, all kinds of incredible trucks and jeeps and artillery pieces and everything, and played a huge role in helping the Russians defeat Nazi Germany in the Battle of Kursk and other places which were real turning points. So there's that history as well. Iran was the way that Russia could get this lend-lease stuff and help it defeat the Germans. Then, of course, after the war, there was communism, and there was a Tudeh party in Iran. There was a communist party, and then we had a mixture. And then in 1953, the CIA with the MI6 in Britain taking it by the shoulders. And now you're new about this, but this is what we do when an upstart third world guy like Mossadegh, yeah, who is freely elected. Yeah, he's the only freely elected person in Iran in three millennia. Yeah, but doesn't matter. This is what you do when they think that the oil underneath the soil of Iran belongs to the Iranian people. Throw thumb over. And that happened. That was the first really big regime change. Next one was Guatemala and then down the line. So that was the beginning of the real problem between Iran and Russia. And then, of course, Khomeini came in, as John described. What's new is that there's a comprehensive treaty between Russia and Iran now. There are planes that the corridor that runs down from the north through Iran is essential for economic development that Russia foresees. And there's a mutual acceptance of the fact that, look, we can cooperate with each other. The Russians were reluctant to pledge to go immediately to war if Iran was attacked. Now, they did that for obvious reasons, but I would suggest that they didn't do that with respect to North Korea. North Korea's treaty with Russia is a mutual defense treaty. Iran's is slightly less, but it's virtually that. And Russian interests in Iran are such that Russia will not sit back and, as we used to say, sit back idly and watch the U.S. or Israel or both of them attack Iran. Neither will the Chinese. The Chinese, at last time I checked, the Chinese depend for 40%. 30 to 40% of their oil from the Persian Gulf. Now, will the Chinese sit by idly? No. Do they have a capability of intervening? No. But they have lots of capability to rattle the sabers around Taiwan or do other things in the South China Sea. They have lots of capability to make sure that they and the Russians and the Iranians are bound at the hip right now on this particular project. And as John mentioned, the three of them, high-level representatives from Iran, China, and Russia, were in Moscow to watch what happened when Netanyahu and Trump had their last meeting, and they coordinated their response. And then you saw Witkoff go to Moscow, and then go to Oman. And, you know, we have the whole thing playing out as we've depicted, but the Iranian-Russian relationship now is better than ever since, except for when the U.S. was supplying all kinds of critical equipment from Studebaker, from Ford, from General Motors, through Iran into Russia to help Russia defeat the Nazis 80 years ago, almost to the day.
Yeah. John, do you want to ask?
Well, again, don't want to bore the audience with how much Ray and I agree. There is the Syrian problem, the Bashar al-Assad problem, which has created a higher level of distrust and suspicion between the Iranian side and the Russian side for months. And there's a very good document, which I'll put up for our audience in the Dances with Bears that'll follow this program, by an English analyst named Antonio, I'm looking at the paper, Antonio Giustozzi. And what he's done in a paper called Russia and the Collapse of the Assad Regime is to have interviewed over several years Syrian military, Iranian military sources, and Russian military sources in Syria. Now, to be sure, Dr. Giustozzi works for the British military think tank, RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, and you have to discount the truth value of anything coming out of a British military think tank like that. On the other hand, the sources speak for themselves, and there was and remains a degree of suspicion, which we talked about on this program, as Russia withdrew under the Turkish drive south from Idlib towards Damascus. So there's nothing new in what happened. We reported it at the time. We discussed it at the time. But I have to say that on the Russian side and on the Iranian side, there remains a sore point. And the way that Russia has to convince both the Iranian ally and everyone else that it's not going to do to Khamenei and Pezeshkian what it is perceived to have allowed to happen to Bashar al-Assad, that's a pudding that has to be eaten and proved. So what the Russian side is busy doing is reinforcing its readiness to defend Iran at the level of the January pact. But I don't think it helps our audience or ourselves to minimize the level of friction, suspicion, and doubt that arose in Syria over the past 12 months. And taking all of the qualifications, Ray and I agree about with the RUSI think tank, Giustozzi's record of what his Syrian, Iranian, and Russian sources have been telling him seems to me a fair account of a level of suspicion that Russia's foreign ministry and general staff are doing their level best to overcome right now.
Yeah. Ray, do you want to add something?
Well, not on that issue. I think that we've covered that pretty much, unless you have other questions, Nima.
Yeah. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Ray and John, for being with us today. Great pleasure. Well,
let me add one thing, Nima, if I may.
Go ahead.
You know, these ceasefire things have been inchoate. They've been sort of like, you don't know when they start, you don't know when they stop, you don't know if they're in existence, okay? But the ceasefire thing that was arranged to ostensibly prevent Russia and Ukraine from hitting each other's energy supply centers, and I mean the big ones, the transformers and the whole business, that expires in 2 days. We know that, okay? That was April 18th. Now, 2 days is, no. Yeah. May 8th. What was this? No, it was March 18th, and now it's April 18th. Okay. So, what's going to happen? think all hell's going to break loose. The Russians have no reason to respect an agreement that the Ukrainians never respected. And, you know, to the degree they hold off for two more days, well, they probably have plans not to do a major thing against the energy supplies until about now anyway. They do about every month. So look for that. The Russians are not going to hold back on that. And they're going to continue to attrit and attrit and attrit. And this would be a lesson to Trump and his folks. Look, you know, you really ought to get your act together, get reasonable terms, and we can deal. But otherwise, it's going to be a complete embarrassment for you as we attrit all the way up to the Dnieper and maybe even farther. So I just wanted to throw that in, because in 2 days, we'll know a little bit more. And then in 3 days, we'll have Witkoff talking again. So we'll know more then. It's really kind of fun to, in a way, to keep up with all this stuff. And Nima, thanks for having us on regularly. It's a discipline that I enjoy.
I can only add to that, and it's we're not trying to top each other, that there were 6 Ukrainian attacks violating the energy ceasefire, the energy infrastructure ceasefire yesterday. And when asked whether, and there have been dozens, maybe the number is hundreds of Ukrainian attacks on Russian energy infrastructure during this past month, March 18 to April 18, in which President Putin promised and delivered a unilateral energy infrastructure ceasefire during the presidential telephone call. When asked in the last 24 hours whether Russia will resume attacks, Dmitry Peskov, President Putin's spokesman, has basically said that's a military decision and it's a political decision that hasn't been made yet. At the same time, we've seen the Russian missile attack on Ukrainian forces hiding behind civilians in Kryvyi Rog, exploited as an attempt by Zelensky, the Ukrainian government, and the Anglo-American media to make the case that Russia's just committed another war crime over the weekend, when in fact the war crime was that the Ukrainians use civilian shields and civilian facilities to conceal military meetings. The publicity and the propaganda warfare associated with Kryvyi Rog attack tells the Russian side that no matter what they do, whether they don't attack the energy infrastructure according to a ceasefire agreed with President Trump, or whether they do and resume in 2 days' time, or whether they aim at military concentrations in the Ukraine, or whether they don't, no matter what they do, the propaganda organs, especially in Europe, especially the Macron, Starmer, German media, which are now threatening with their new pseudo-chancellor Merz to send in terrorist missiles. No matter what Russia does or does not do, it will be held against it in the way this war is being fought in the information sphere.
Yeah. Sure. Thank you so much, Ray and John, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Most welcome.